made it so unbearable, and people are in jail in these jails now for 2 years, 3 years. That's why it's quote unquote full, because we are no longer doing what we legally have to do, which is to release them on parole.
We're going to continue this discussion in part two, and we'll post online under web exclusives at democracynow.org. Jennifer Harbury, human rights lawyer and activist here in Brownsville as we broadcast from the border. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.
KBOO Community Radio is proud to co-sponsor IRANFORM, U.S. Withdrawal from Nuclear Agreement and Path to War, on Friday, June 29th at 6:30 at the First Unitarian Church in Portland. The IRANFORM will feature Jamal Abdi, Executive Director of the National Iran American Council, journalist Reese Ehrlich, and local speakers in a discussion about withdrawing from the Iran nuclear deal. The sponsoring groups are involved in prevention of war and in supporting diplomacy and friendship with the people of Iran. Again, that's the Iran Forum U.S. Withdrawal from the Nuclear Agreement and Path to War on Friday, June 29th at 6:30 at the First Unitarian Church, 1211 Southwest Main Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
Listen to The Film Show, the fourth Thursday of each month at 11:30 a.m. The Film Show features news and interviews about the local and independent film scene. That's The Film Show, the fourth Thursday of the month at 11:30 a.m., only on KBOO Portland.
KBOO Portland, 90.7 FM. Hood River, 91.9 FM, on translator K220HR. And in Philomath at 104.3 FM, K282BH, Philomath.
Welcome to Sojourner Truth. Thank you for staying with us. This is your host, Margaret Prescott. Today, reaction from two major Muslim American organizations to the Supreme Court ruling that ruled in favor of the Trump regime, which allows what many are still referring to as a Muslim ban. In defending the ban, Trump justified it, saying that the U.S. had interned Japanese people during World War II for national security reasons. The Supreme Court ruling was met with protests around the country. The decision also brought a sharp rebuke from Supreme Court Justice Sonia Sotomayor, who in her defense made reference to Japanese internment by referencing the Korematsu versus the United States, a 1944 ruling that upheld the U.S. detention of people of Japanese descent living in the United States. Our guests are Farida Chehata, the Immigrants' Rights Managing Attorney at CARE Los Angeles, and Ryan Suto, the Government Relations Manager for the Arab American Institute and serves as its policy counsel. And the long-term impact of migrant children being held at the border. Our guest is Richard Wexler, Executive Director of the National Coalition for Child Protection Reform. For our Campaigners for Black Lives series, we speak with Pittsburgh-based Jaziri X. He is a rapper and activist. We discuss the police shooting and killing of Antoine Rose. We live in a global world. We're all interrelated. So on Sojourner Truth, we work to bring directly to you news and views on local, national, and international policies and stories that affect us all. And we draw out how those of us most impacted, women, communities of color, and other communities are responding. We also discuss the interrelationship between art and politics. Now for our news headlines.
For Pacifica Radio, I'm Eileen Alfandari. A San Diego federal judge has ordered the Trump administration to reunite separated immigrant children with their parents within 30 days, 14 days if the child is younger than 5 years old. Federal Judge Dana Sabra also issued a nationwide injunction on future family separations, unless the parent is deemed unfit or doesn't want to be with the child. He also requires the government provide phone contact between parents and their children within 10 days. Sabra said in his ruling, quote, "The situation has reached a crisis level. The news media is saturated with stories of immigrant families being separated at the border. People are protesting. Elected officials are weighing in. Congress is threatening action," the judge wrote. In a speech before the Conservative Criminal Justice Legal Foundation in Los Angeles, Attorney General Jeff Sessions defended the administration for taking a hard-line stance on undocumented immigrants and said the voters elected President Donald Trump to do just that. Police arrested 24 clergy who were among hundreds of people protesting Sessions' appearance. Some of the protesters chanted, "Nazi, go home." Dan Fritz reports.
They sang songs about love and acceptance as police took 24 clergy members into custody outside the federal courthouse on Spring Street Tuesday. The clergy members objected to Sessions quoting Bible verses while defending his border policies. The religious leaders and immigrant rights activists said that for them, it's not about politics, it's about humanity. Xochitl Sanchez is with CARESEN, the Central American Resource Center. She told Univision that what's happening is inhumane.
And it's enough. We can't let it go on this way. It's not going to stop with Sessions. It's not going to stop with Trump. The Democrats have to do more. We have to demand that the Democrats do more.
At his speech at the downtown Millennium Biltmore Hotel, Sessions characterized his opposition as supporting open borders.
This immigration question is a decisive issue for our time. As the president often says, a country without borders is not a country. I don't know why that's so hard for some people to understand.
Dan Fritz, Pacifica Radio KPFK, Los Angeles.
President Donald Trump declared the U.S. Supreme Court 5-4 ruling upholding his ban on travel from five mostly Muslim nations a moment of profound vindication.
This is a great victory for our Constitution. We have to be tough and we have to be safe and we have to be secure.
Chief Justice John Roberts wrote that the travel ban was well within U.S. president's considerable authority over immigration and responsibility for keeping the nation safe. He rejected the challenger's claim of anti-Muslim bias that rested in large part on Trump's own tweets and statements over the past 3 years. In a stinging dissent, Justice Sonia Sotomayor read aloud Trump's numerous anti-Muslim tweets and statements and said, "History will not look kindly on the court's misguided decision today, nor should it." The decision drew nationwide condemnation, protests, and warnings of what Trump may do next. Farhana Kara is with the group Muslim Advocates.
With this decision, we are concerned that Donald Trump will move beyond the five Muslim majority countries that are in the current version to not only target more countries, but potentially even go after U.S. citizens and lawful permanent residents. We call on all Americans to join with us in standing up to this egregious policy.
A political earthquake in New York's Queens and Bronx congressional district, where Democratic Socialist 28-year-old Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez ousted 10-term Congressman Joe Crowley in last night's Democratic primary, 58-42%.
I cannot believe these numbers right now, but I do know that every single person here has worked their butt off to change the future of the Bronx and Queens. That's what I know. That's what I know. And that this victory belongs to every single grassroots organizer, every working parent, every mom, every member of the LGBTQ community. Every single person is responsible for this.
Ocasio-Cortez is the daughter of a Puerto Rican mother and father born in the Bronx and a former Bernie Sanders organizer. She has joined the call for abolition of immigration and customs enforcement, ICE, supports Medicare for All, a national $15 an hour minimum wage, tuition-free public college, and 100% renewable energy by the year 2035. Maryland Democrats nominated former NAACP leader Ben Jealous on a platform of tuition-free college. Raising the state's minimum wage to $15, he will face incumbent Republican Governor Larry Hogan in the fall. In Utah, Mitt Romney became the Republican nominee for a Senate seat. I'm Eileen Alfandari. You're listening to Sojourner Truth on Pacifica Radio.
This is Margaret Prescott, host of Sojourner Truth. As a presidential candidate, Donald Trump called for a total and complete shutdown of Muslims entering the United States. When he announced his first Muslim ban in January 2017, shortly after taking office, thousands of people across the country responded by hitting the streets and airports in protest. A few days later, a federal judge in Seattle temporarily blocked the executive order. A second version was also struck down by a federal judge in Hawaii in March 2017. Now, Trump, in defending the ban, said Franklin Delano Roosevelt did the same thing when he ordered the internment of people of Japanese descent living in the United States. This, of course, sets off alarm bells still and takes on new meaning now with the detention of migrant children. The Supreme Court, which has a conservative majority after Trump appointed Gorsuch, has given him a huge victory in siding with him on his third and latest version of the Muslim ban. Yesterday, Tuesday, June 26th, the Supreme Court voted 5-4 in the case of Trump versus Hawaii and upholding Trump's Muslim ban barring entry to the United States for people from majority Muslim countries. The ban includes restrictions against Iran, Libya, Somalia, Syria, and Yemen. Some restriction was placed on North Korea and, interestingly enough, on Venezuelan government officials. Chad was originally on the list, but it was removed after allegedly meeting security requirements. So we're being told by the Trump administration. This was the third and final version of the contested ban. Earlier versions had been struck down by various parts by courts. Unlike earlier versions of the ban, the current restrictions don't have an expiration date, the Wall Street Journal reports. The first version of the ban banned entry for people from Iran, Iraq, Libya, Somalia, Sudan, Syria, and Yemen for 90 days and indefinitely halted resettlement of refugees from Syria's civil war. The existing ban is narrower than Trump's first attempt, and this due in part to public outrage and protest and early court defeats in 2017. Justices Sonia Sotomayor and Ruth Bader Ginsburg were among the four judges who voted against upholding the ban, calling it one of the most troubling rulings in recent memory. The Justices Elena Kagan and Stephen Breyer also dissented. Justice Sotomayor said that a reasonable observer would conclude Trump's ban was, quote, motivated by anti-Muslim animus, even though it, quote, now masquerades behind a facade of national security concerns. Sotomayor also drew parallels between the decision and the Korematsu versus United States, the 1944 ruling that upheld the detention of Japanese Americans during World War II. Quote, the government invoked an ill-defined national security threat to justify an exclusionary policy of sweeping proportion, she said. This according to the New York Times. The exclusion was rooted in dangerous stereotypes about inter alia a group, particular group's supposed inability to assimilate and desire to harm the United States. Let us go now to a clip on the Supreme Court ruling.
Let's go back to Jessica. The decision has been announced. Go ahead, Jessica.
Yeah, Wolf, the Supreme Court has reversed the Ninth Circuit. And what that means is that this Supreme Court is upholding the president's travel ban. We're still reading through this very lengthy opinion, but we know that it was a 5-4 decision. It was written by Chief Justice John Roberts. It was also joined by the crucial swing vote in many of these cases, Justice Anthony Kennedy. But the bottom line here is that the Supreme Court has upheld the president's right to enact this travel ban. Remember, this was a travel ban in its third iteration now. It bans travel for certain classes of people from several different countries. And this was a hotly contested issue within the administration. Also, hotly contested issue at oral arguments just 2 months ago. So the Supreme Court saying today the president does have the authority under immigration laws in this country to enact this travel ban. This was something that restricted travel from several countries, not all of them Muslim majority. They did, in fact, include North Korea as well as Venezuela. And the Solicitor General, Noel Francisco, when he argued this case 2 months ago, he made that point. He said that the administration had done a worldwide vetting of countries throughout the world to see exactly how they handled travelers and visas, and they determined that these countries just didn't meet the standards. So, in fact, the Supreme Court has sided with the administration in this case. They have upheld the travel ban here under the terms of immigration law, saying it is well within the president's authority.
And we're now going to get reaction to the Supreme Court decision. I'd like to welcome Farida Jahata, Immigrant Rights Managing Attorney at CARE Los Angeles. Farida, welcome.
Thank you. Good morning.
Good morning. I'd also like to welcome Ryan J. Suto. He is the Government Relations Manager for the Arab American Institute and serves as its policy counsel. Ryan, welcome.
Thank you for having me.
Okay, so Farida, let's start with you before we dig into this a bit, just to give the reaction from your organization, and also tell us a bit about your organization and who they represent.
Sure. So the Council on American-Islamic Relations is the largest American Muslim civil rights organization. We work on civil rights issue. We do advocacy. We work on immigrants' rights as well. And we've been working on this Muslim ban issue since it started back in January of 2017. So we've been working on a grassroots level with community members that have been impacted by this ban and responding to individuals that have felt targeted and have felt, a lot of apprehension and uncertainty because of the administration's policies targeting Muslims in the United States.
Yes, and Ryan.
Yes, so the Arab American Institute represents the nation's millions of Arab Americans throughout the country. We try to promote civil advocacy among the Arab American population, and we've been following this case since the ban first came down last January, trying to keep our members abreast of their ever-changing rights and privileges under the law.
Right. So, and just back to you, Ryan, for a moment. You know, it's being referred to in the mainstream press as a travel ban. Basically, I don't buy it. I think it's just a Muslim ban. And I wondered if you agreed with that, because they did throw in Venezuela government officials and they threw in North Korea. I don't know if the idea of that was to take it off the scent or having to do with other pressures that they want to put on those particular countries. But do you think this is a Muslim ban?
Yes, our organization explicitly and solely uses the moniker Muslim ban for the exact reason. The ban focuses almost exclusively, if you look at the numbers of those impacted, on countries that are majority Muslim. As you mentioned, Venezuela is only included certain noted government officials and their family, and fewer than 1,000 people from North Korea apply for any type of visa to the United States in a year. So the vast majority of those who would be impacted by this, who have been impacted by this policy over the past year and a half, are indeed Muslim.
Yeah, and back to you, Farida. Have you seen, has your organization seen an uptick in Islamophobia since Trump won the election and is in power? I mean, he has been whipping up anti-Muslim sentiment. So just tell us about what are some of the fears and concerns and reaction to Muslim members of your organization, your network, families and friends.
Yeah, so we've definitely seen an uptick in hate incidents. We've seen an uptick in criminal activity targeting Muslims after each one of these policies goes into play. So people have been attacked. We've had people calling us that have had their hijabs ripped off. Many, many people that get apprehended on the roads while they're driving. We've had mosques throughout the nation that have been, you know, put on fire. I mean, this is really, really problematic. And what's even more problematic is that everybody who is of Middle Eastern or who's Muslim has felt targeted. We've received calls from citizens as well as immigrants, as well as foreigners. So while the president might be trying to veil this Muslim ban with a national security interest and using that rhetoric to try to advance his hidden agenda, what we've seen is that in reality, this has really created a lot of confusion and dismay and a fear among Muslims that feel that they are being targeted and, in fact, have been targeted. These policies have really emboldened, people that have xenophobic and have Islamophobic and anti-Muslim sentiments. So it's been problematic on many different levels.
Yes, and Ryan, I mean, this whole saga really right after January 2017 when Trump signed that first executive order where there was such an outpouring on the part of thousands of people across the country. And this fight has been going on ever since, all the way up to the Supreme Court. Now, Ryan, did your network expect this ruling? And what are the other options now? Because, I mean, in terms of fighting it out in the court, isn't this it? Are there other options?
Ryan. So there are options. We were fearing and bracing for some level of defeat, given the makeup of the court that you alluded to earlier in the piece. But there are things left to be done. As was mentioned, this decision was based on statutes. So the Supreme Court interpreted a law that was passed by Congress, which gave the president authority. We can't change the Supreme Court decision and the Supreme Court's interpretation of that law, but Congress can still change that law. This is the INA, which was enacted in the 1950s. There's nothing stopping from Congress from changing the text that the Supreme Court interpreted so to make it more clear that the president cannot do what he is doing. So now I think the fight should turn to Congress. The midterm elections are coming up, as you know, and advocates around the country should hold candidates to the fire and ensure that candidates promise that they would enact legislation which will overturn the basis for the president's authority, as interpreted by the Supreme Court, to enact this Muslim ban.
Right. And, you know, Farida, you know, Stephen Miller, who is a senior policy advisor in the Trump White House, a real hardliner on immigration issues, and he's really seemed to be pushing a lot of these policies. And the scary part of it is now Trump is now looking at this Supreme Court victory to perhaps even widen, right, the scope of really attacks on immigrants and which immigrants get to enter this country and which immigrants do not. There was even some talk of deporting people who were naturalized citizens in the United States. Some of that is already happening, but they're talking about revoking citizenship. And who knows how far they're going to go with this. Now, Bannon was okay. He was fired. There were a lot of people pushing him out of the White House. Stephen Miller, however, is still there. And I wonder if there will be any efforts to try to ease him out of the White House. Who knows if this will have any difference with Trump's policies or not. But just your reaction, because Congress, the way it's made up right now, they're just going to go along with Trump. So what do you think the next moves have to be?
Farida. Yeah, so I want to just reiterate Ryan's comments that we need to continue pushing this, both, you know, with Congress, who have the ability to write a bill that rescinds many of the policies. This is what's really problematic, is that we've been working for the past year and a half against these anti-immigrant policies, right? So a lot of what you highlighted has been very problematic and something that we've had to deal with, you know, when you have separation of families at borders, when you have separation of families through this Muslim ban, you have the rescission of DACA, you have other policies that are really problematic in affecting immigrants. So really, this just indicates to us that we need to continue fighting this. We need to continue educating community members on the implications of these policies, and we need to continue questioning the statements that are being made, because many of them are inaccurate, most of them are inaccurate, and really are just breeding on a sense of fear from community members that feel that outsiders are going to come and take their jobs or are going to threaten their safety and their security in the United States. And that's, in fact, not true. And so it's really the obligation of every citizen to really become educated and understand, you know, the truth and the underlying implications of the comments and policies that are being perpetuated by this administration, and to continue fighting this fight.
Right. And Ryan, I mean, this is, I'm an immigrant myself. I'm immigrant from the Caribbean region. And, you know, the whole attack now coming down on immigrants, the whole thing of Trump also going after what he's calling chain migration, when, frankly speaking, just about everybody in the United States, except for indigenous people who had their land stolen and millions of them killed, are really immigrants and are a result of the very chain migration that Trump now also wants to go after. But also, Ryan, within the context of children, babies now being separated at the border, these tent cities really being set up in the middle of the desert in the heat, where children are snatched away from their families, the fact of Trump justifying it by saying, well, Roosevelt did the same thing with the internment of Japanese Americans during World War II, and Supreme Court member Justice Sonia Sotomayor, she referenced that and the case, the Korematsu versus the United States, because this is scary stuff, okay? Because who knows what else could be used or who could be rounded up in the name of national security. Just your reaction to all of this, not to mention all of the pain and suffering of families being torn apart, being ripped apart here. Ryan.
No, I agree completely. And I think, Sonia Sotomayor later writes in her defense that the ruling ignores the facts and it turns a blind eye to the pain and suffering that this administration inflicts on people. And I think that's exactly right. She mentioned Korematsu, and she actually forced the majority to also mention Korematsu, and they symbolically overturned that decision.
Right.
But I give that no credence, because it takes no conviction, it takes no courage to overturn something which the court itself has stated has been overturned by history. But what does take courage and conviction is to stand up for those facing injustice today. And they refused to do that in the travel ban case. And they, you know, there was a federal judge, I think last night, that was mentioned that issued an injunction on the child separation. If that goes to the Supreme Court, they'll have another opportunity to face injustice. And yesterday's ruling gives me no confidence that they would be on the right side of history at that time.
Okay, so it seems as though we just really have a minute or so left, that what you both are saying, that what needs to happen now, will the midterm elections, a lot depends, a lot rides on the midterm elections. So everybody who perhaps sat out the presidential election and who said, well, there's no difference between the two and I'm not going to vote and all of that sort of thing. I mean, are you now saying to people that folks have to get out and vote? Farida, just a quick final thought from you, and then a final thought from you, Ryan.
Yeah, so it's of paramount importance. I think everything that's happening reflects that. And people that said that it didn't matter which person got elected, they should look at the separation of families and the Muslim ban and just the multiple other issues that are happening right now and see if, in fact, it does matter, right, who we elect. So they do need to turn out and vote. That's their right and that's their voice.
Right. And Ryan?
I agree completely. Our organization has a program called Yellow Vote, which encourages Arab Americans across the country to go out and vote and register. And we are pushing that hard because, as mentioned, these midterms could change the lives of many underserved and targeted communities across this country and outside this country who might wish to come in.
Right. Well, I want to thank you both, and really just our sympathy and hearts go out to all of the Muslim community in this country and your organizations and across the country who are so impacted by this. And I think that, you know, all of us really should feel under threat and feel that we have to just do something, even if it is going out and voting. So Farida Chehata from CARE Los Angeles, Ryan J. Soto from the Arab American Institute, thank you both for joining us.
Thank you, Margaret.
All righty, we're going to take a short station break. And coming up, still on immigration, but the children, the impact on children of being snatched, separated from their mothers or their main caregivers. Richard Wexler, of the executive director of the National Coalition for Child Protection Reform, is waiting to speak with us. And also, rapper Jaziri X, based in Pittsburgh, and ready to join us to discuss the police killing of Antoine Rose and its aftermath. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
There'll come a time.
There'll come a time.
When the world won't be singing.
When the world won't be singing.
Flowers won't grow.
Flowers won't grow. No.
Bells won't be ringing.
No, bells won't be ringing.
Who really cares?
Who really cares?
Who's willing to try?
All righty, and the song, the late, great Marvin Gaye, Save the Children. This is Margaret Prescott, host of Sojourner Truth. If you've missed any part of this hour, from 10 this morning for 90 days after that, just go to kpfk.org, scroll down to archives, click on Sojourner Truth. You'll be able to hear the show in its entirety, and you can subscribe for a free podcast where you could hear the show anytime, anywhere. And you could also check us out on our website at www.sotrueradio.org, where all of our back shows are also archived there. And if you're a member of Facebook, you can like and friend us on Facebook. We're also on SoundCloud. Look for Sojourner Truth with Margaret Prescott. And today we would like to give a shout out to our SoundCloud listeners in the state of Pennsylvania, in particular the city of Pittsburgh. Now, just some updates here on the separation of children from their families. A federal judge in San Diego has barred the separation of immigrant children and ordered that those currently detained under the Trump administration's zero policy be reunited with families within 30 days. This is a report from NPR. The order is a result of an American Civil Liberties Union, ACLU, lawsuit. It was issued late on Tuesday night. The nationwide injunction was issued on behalf of a single Honduran mom who was split from her six-year-old daughter after arriving in the U.S. in 2017. Now, children younger who are detained in federally contracted shelters must be returned to their parents within 14 days. Parents are entitled to speak with their children within 10 days. A Department of Health and Human Services official said Tuesday night that 2,047 migrant children who were separated from their families under the zero tolerance policy. They are currently in the care of the Office of Refugee Resettlement. And HHS official Jonathan White said a total of 11,800 children across the country are in care of the Office of Refugee Settlement Shelter Network. 83% of them are minors under the age of 18 who entered the country without legal status. The policy of breaking up families at the Mexico border is being challenged by 17 U.S. states. Democratic attorneys general from states including Washington, New York, and California launched the suit. Let us go now to a short clip from Associated Press on the migrant children's separation.
As of this morning, Health and Human Services, Homeland Security, and the Justice Department seem to be doing more to add to the bedlam and deflect blame than they're doing to tell parents where their kids are. How many kids who were in your custody because of the zero tolerance policy have been reunified with a parent or a relative?
So I believe we have had a high of over 2,300 children that were separated from their parents as a result of the enforcement policy. We now have 2,047.
How many have been reunified?
So they would be unified with either parents or other relatives under our policy. So, of course, if the parent remains in detention, unfortunately, under rules that are set by Congress and the courts, they can't be reunified while they're in detention.
So is the answer zero? I mean,
we've had hundreds of children who had been separated who are now with, for instance, if there was another parent who's here in the country.
I want to know about the children in your department's custody. How many of them have been reunified?
Well, that's exactly what I'm saying. They have been placed with a parent or other relative who's here in the United States.
How many?
Several hundred.
Of
the 2,300 plus that came into our care, we only have 2,047.
How many parents have been told where their kids are?
Every parent has access to know where their child is.
Yeah, right. If you would believe that, that was HHS Secretary Alex Azar being pushed. Question, it sounded like Senator Blumenthal of Connecticut. And we know that's not true because there have been so many stories of parents who have not been able to contact their children. What I'd like to do now is to welcome to Sojourner Truth Richard Wexler, Executive Director of the National Coalition for Child Protection Reform. And he also worked for 19 years as a reporter, as a journalist for newspapers, public radio, and public television. And during that time, he won more than two dozen awards, many of them for stories about child abuse and foster care. He is the author of Wounded Innocence, The Real Victims of the War Against Child Abuse. He's testified before Congress and state legislators, and advised the U.S. Senate Subcommittee on Children and Families in the 1995 rewrite of the Child Abuse Prevention and Treatment Act. Richard Wexler, welcome.
Thank you very much. It's great to be here.
Okay, so Richard Wexler, you being an expert in this area, and but not so much on the detention of children at the border, but certainly what's happening now, a lot of these children are going to be pouring into, some already have, into group homes or child welfare agencies in the United States. And we know that those agencies are rife with problems. But before we talk about that, let's talk about the long-term impact, short-term and long-term impacts of children when they are snatched from their main caregiver.
Well, a professor of pediatrics talked about this in the Washington Post, and he boiled it down to one word: catastrophic. When you tear a child from the person he knows and loves, consign that child to the care of strangers, it does literal physical brain damage in some cases. It does enormous trauma to the child psychologically, and it can sometimes scar the children for life. I am reminded and I wrote about this on the NCCPR blog, of a case I wrote about in my book, in which a three-year-old is being torn from her mother, and she's screaming, "I'm sorry, I'm sorry, I'm sorry," because in her mind, all she can think is, she must have done something terribly wrong, and now she is being punished. That wasn't a Border Patrol officer taking that child. It was a sheriff's deputy in California acting at the behest of Child Protective Services. It doesn't matter who's taking the child, or whether they are well-motivated, as most in CPS are, or whether they are acting out of pure evil, as the Trump administration is. For the child, the motivation doesn't matter. The trauma is the same.
Yeah, you know, Richard, it's really hard to talk about this story. I mean, I'm a mom. I was a single mom for a long time. And you just think of how close one could become to, you know, having your child taken from you. You know, increasingly we see across the country children being taken from their families, not because of abuse, but because the families are poor. So increasingly people are making the connection with the suffering of the children, the migrant children, just this horrific thing that is happening right now, and connecting it with what is going on across this country with children being taken because their families are poor. Just your comments on that.
It has been encouraging to see that, encouraging to see people starting to connect the dots.
Yeah.
Part of the problem, part of what makes it difficult, is the rhetoric of Child Protective Services agencies in trying to justify needless removal of children is remarkably similar to the rhetoric of Donald Trump. What did Donald Trump go and do when he was coming under fire? He met with relatives in the extremely rare, extremely tragic cases where undocumented immigrants have committed serious crimes. Those, of course, bear no resemblance to the parents coming across the border and having their children taken. Similarly, advocates of a take-the-child-and-run approach to U.S. child welfare point to the extremely rare, extremely tragic cases in which children, quote, known to the system, die. They do that to justify taking away thousands of children in cases that are nothing like that. As you said, probably the biggest single problem in the child welfare system is the confusion of poverty with neglect. At least 30% of America's foster children could be home right now if their families simply had decent housing. Many more could be home if the family simply had other kinds of help. But exactly the same kind of fear-mongering that Trump uses to justify his take-the-child-and-run policy, it's the same kind of fear-mongering that people like the man who runs the Los Angeles County Department of Children and Family Services, Bobby Cagle, uses to justify taking away too many children in Los Angeles County.
Yeah, and the response from the Trump administration's Secretary of Homeland Security, Kirstjen Nielsen, she shrugged off family separation accusations. She said that it was, quote, people were saying it was a form of state terror. And her response was, well, we do it every day in every part of the country. Family separation is a fact of life here, happening hundreds, if not thousands of times a day in the United States. She said, we call that law enforcement. Your reaction?
Well, I actually agree with her. Family separation is taking place over and over again in the United States. She references law enforcement. Even more often, it's a case of Child Protective Services. Where I disagree is when she shrugs it off as harmless. The number of children taken away through this entire zero tolerance so-called policy at the border is roughly equal to the number that Child Protective Services take away every 3 days in the United States.
Yeah.
270,000 or more are taken over the course of a year.
Oh,
now,
God.
Again, some of them really needed to be taken. Very few, but some. And the people doing it mean well, but the consequences for the wrongfully removed children are exactly the same.
Right, and the overwhelming numbers are wrongfully taken. Yes. And Richard Wexler, also, we find that there is lifelong trauma with children snatched from their families. A lot of these children are suffering from PTSD. When we look at who ends up in prison, you find a lot of them are people who have come through the foster care system. We see that the single mothers are the fastest growing population of people going to prison. And once you are in prison, your child, of course, is taken and you could actually lose parental rights. So as you say, people are beginning to connect the dots. And I don't want to, in bringing up the 270,000 children taken by child welfare each year in the United States, to diminish in any way the horror of what is going on in the border and the fact that we really have to stay laser focused on that. But we also have to look at the bigger picture and connect this to what is happening in the United States, but also around the world. I mean, there are 13,000 immigrants from out the continent of Africa that are now stranded in the Sahara Desert, just dumped there, right? As though their lives mean absolutely nothing. So this is really part of a much bigger picture, Richard Wexler. And the final thing, and I'd like you to comment on all of those, is that we're finding now that 22% of all federal dollars spent on child welfare in the United States come from welfare, comes from money that should be going to mothers and families to keep their families together. But instead, this money is now going in to remove those children from poverty, and that a lot of abuse also happens. Let's face it, not everything good happens in foster care homes or individual homes or group homes. Final comment, Richard Wexler.
Well, what is most striking is this. There was a massive study done about 10 years ago that compared the outcomes in typical cases of children left in their own homes or children placed in foster care. Consistently, the children left in their own homes did better. That tells you that even in the best of circumstances, foster care is an extremely toxic intervention that should be used rarely and in small doses. America has prescribed mega doses of foster care. It's even worse when you consider study after study has found abuse in 25% to 33% of foster homes, and the rate in group homes and institutions is even worse. So that's why it is so important. And while I am thrilled, for example, that the ACLU has taken the action it has taken concerning the border, it has been a long-standing concern that at the national level, some state chapters understand the child welfare issues, but at the national issue, at the national level, when it comes to child welfare and what foster care does to kids, the ACLU has been AWOL. And I'm hoping now maybe that will change.
And for people who want to learn more about the National Coalition for Child Protection Reform, what should they do?
Just go to our website, nccpr.org.
Richard Wexler, thank you for joining us and thank you for your work.
Thank you very much.
This is Margaret Prescott, host of Sojourner Truth. Now, young black man Antoine Rose was shot dead on Tuesday, June 19th, by Allegheny County Police Officer Michael Rosfeld. Protests began shortly after the June 19th shooting. Hundreds have been protesting on the streets, we're being told. And the Pittsburgh Police Department has now implemented 12-hour shifts for police officers as of Tuesday, June 26th, in response to the protests. Also, police have announced that on Tuesday, June 26th, that two guns were found in the car that Rose ran from. And later that day, Allegheny County police arrested a teenager in connection to an alleged drive-by shooting that took place right before Rose was pulled over. The reality is Rose was running away. He had no weapon. He was shot in the back. Let us just go to a clip to hear some community response to the killing of Antoine Rose.
What's going through your mind now as you head to the funeral?
It's going to be hard for everybody. to go to a 17-year-old criminal. My heart goes out. Being a parent, I think that's where my strongest feelings are, you know, to see, because I have sons, and it could have been my son. He always has a bright smile. He would say goodbye, hello to me, and being a substitute, you don't get that from the students here.
You don't hear no white kids getting shot in the back. I can't even recall a white kid getting shot in the back, but you got a white kid that can go down and shoot up a church, shoot up schools, and they take him to Burger King.
Tell me, what has the community reaction been like?
Outrage, because it just keeps happening over and over and over again. You know, no matter if there's photographs or videos, they always seem to find a way to explain things away, but there's no explaining this away. Yes. There's no explaining this away. There's no explaining this away.
And as a member of this community, what message do you think his death sends to other young men in this community?
Now is the time that we stand together and we demand results. We demand results.
We demand a result. That is a clip from NBC Black. I'd like to welcome for this Campaigners for Black Lives weekly series, Jaziri X, based in Pittsburgh, a rapper and activist, nationally known. You people might remember the song Free the Janus 6. He is a recipient of the Rauschenberg Artist as Activist Award, founder of the anti-violence group One Hood, and in 2016, he was awarded an honorary doctorate from the Chicago Theological Seminary. Jaziri X, thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me on.
Okay, tell us what has been happening with the protests that still seem to be going on, and anything new about this case that you would like to share with us.
Well, I want to kind of always thank the young woman who recorded the video. I don't think if we had that video, you know, it would probably have been a whole different narrative that the police put out. But it was a young woman who actually recorded Michael Roosevelt shooting Antoine Rose three times in his back as he was running away. So, that footage was shared Tuesday night, the night of the 19th, and that Wednesday we were at the East Pittsburgh Police Department. He's a police officer, Roosevelt, in East Pittsburgh, which is right outside the city of Pittsburgh. You know, hundreds of people went to the police station, protested there, and, you know, the next morning we were outside of Allegheny County Courthouse demanding that the Allegheny County District Attorney Zapala charge this officer with Antoine's murder. And there have been protests really all the way through the weekend until Sunday, which was the viewing, and Monday, which was the funeral. We took those days off, keep in mind that the family and wanting to center Antoine's life. Tuesday morning, we were back out there, and, you know, the newest update is today that they have Allegheny County District Zapala, DA Zapala has charged Roosevelt with criminal homicide and the murder of Antoine Rose. However, we also found out that he had an unsecured bond, so he didn't even have to pay 1 cent before he walked out free. And so now we all know that if one of us do any type of anything related to homicide, we could have a dime bag of weed in our pocket. Oftentimes, we have to pay before we are let out of jail. Particularly in Allegheny County, most of the people in the Allegheny County right now are there because they can't afford to pay the bail in those cases. And so for this officer to be charged with homicide, to be allowed to go free on unsecured bond, is just another smack in the face to his family and to those of us that have seen this play out again and again in this country.
Right, and we do see it again and again in this country. I mean, what comes to mind also, not only the spate of police killings, but also just police brutality and beatings. I mean, police in Philadelphia, 26 of them beat down 22-year-old, he was 22 years at the time, Tyree Carroll, simply for riding his bicycle the wrong way on a one-way street. On the block, his grandmother grandmother lives on. And then they arrested him, right? And charged him with resisting arrest. And all of those police officers are still on the force getting paid in Philadelphia today. And who knows how many other kids they're beating. You know what I'm saying? So,
right. I mean, yeah. No, absolutely. We had a similar case here in Pittsburgh with a young man named Jordan Miles who was, you know, walking to his grandmother's house when three undercover police officers jumped out on him. He didn't know they were police officers. He ran, and they beat him so badly his mother didn't recognize him. Not only are those officers still on the force in Pittsburgh, the city actually gave them awards after they beat Jordan Miles. So this is something that we've seen played out. And this is why, you know, although we feel like it's a good first step that the district attorney charged Officer Rossfeld, we want to make sure that he's convicted. You know, this is an officer who was fired from his previous job. He was fired with cause, and we found out that he was fired because of how he treated three students, and he falsified the actual, you know, report, and so he was fired. And so although he was even fired, so even when police officers are fired, they can just go to another department, get hired, and then, you know, within 3 hours, Rossfeld was on the job for 3 hours before he shot Antoine Rose three times in his back.
Yeah, and you know, it's hard for a lot of people to understand the grief, really, the deep grief that we feel, you know, across as people of African descent, black and brown people, every time this kind of thing happens. And I'm looking now actually at a press release. I'm sorry, it's embargoed until tomorrow, but I got to share this now. The prestigious Lancet Medical Journal, they're saying that police killings of unarmed black people in the United States impact the mental health of the wider black population. Now, you and I know this to be true. I mean, this has, you know, an impact on all of us. And, you know, as part having to do with the health disparities, and they're saying that police kill more than 300 black people in the United States, at least a quarter of them unarmed each year in the United States. Jaziri.
You know, no, I mean, absolutely. I mean, even, you know, this is kind of, I can't even watch the videos anymore. I mean, you know, it's so many, because it does, it produces a certain effect in how you feel. And, you know, I remember Thursday after we found out and that Antoine Rose was killed by the police, I was just having a conversation. I was at a conference that I spoke at, was having a conversation with an older black woman. And we have an organization, One Hood. One of our young students just came up, told, you know, we had invited our students out to this conference. He told me he was leaving. You know, I gave him a pound. And as he walked out, and I turned to this woman, and she just started busting out in tears. And this is in the middle of a conference, and she just kept saying, like, they're killing our babies. And she was looking at this young man and saying, he's so beautiful, and they are killing our babies. And so, I mean, this is the effect that it has on us. And now, you know, if we're expected to just go to work and do all of these normal things in the midst of what we're seeing, when we're seeing, you know, police officers brutalize and kill our children. If that doesn't have a mental effect on you, I don't know what else will.
Yeah, and also I know this to be true, talking with some folks in public health, that it also has a physical impact. And interesting you mentioned the sister who was weeping, because our elders, you know, a lot of them are leaving us. I mean, Tyree Carroll's grandmother, her health went down after that police beating, and they put her grandson in prison, and she died just a few months ago. She never recovered from this. And I'm convinced that a lot of the elders are really leaving us right now, because they're seeing this modern day lynching. The hurt and the pain goes very, very deep. And then that none of these police officers are being held to account.
Right. And that's where, you know, people have been asking, because we've been protesting every day. You know, we've been shutting down traffic here in Pittsburgh. That, like, okay, now that you got the charge, is like, are the protests going to stop? And it's like, well, we've seen officers. You know, Darren Wilson, who killed Michael Brown, he was charged. Timothy Lohman, who shot and killed Tamir Rice, was charged, but we didn't see them get convicted. Mm-hmm. And so, a charge, although a step, is not enough. We want to make sure that this officer is convicted, because if he's not, then that's not justice. And so we're, you know, looking, is this going to be a jury trial? Is this going to be a judge? And what's taking place? And so, so we're still, you know, going to be raising awareness about this, because we know the more eyes on this, the more likelihood that we get some justice.
Right. Well, Jazeera X, we're going to continue to follow this case. We're out of time now, but we want to, first of all, thank the Black Lives Matter LA. We partner with them for our Campaigners for Black Lives series, particularly Dr. Malina Abdullah. And we want to thank you, Jazeera X. You're out there. You've been consistent with your work. And for people who want to get in touch and who want to support your efforts, Jazeera, what should they do?
Easiest way to reach me is, I'm on social media. I'm on Twitter.
Okay.
Jasiri_X. That's JASIRI_X. Or jasirix.com has all my information.
Right. Well, thank you so very much for joining us. And we're going to continue to follow this story. Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, we're out of time. Today's show produced by Margaret Prescott. I'd like to thank the Sojourner Truth team, our intern, Sherelle Withers, our assistant producer, Romero Funes, and our board op today, Lizette Tapia. We are looking for a new intern. If you would like to come in and help us out here in the mornings, there's a lot to do, a lot to learn. Please email me at mpkpfk@gmail.com. If you'd like a copy of today's show, please contact the Pacifica Radio Archives at 1-800-735-0230, or go online to pacificaradioarchives.org. Sojourner Truth will be back on the air tomorrow. Thank you for listening. This is your host, Margaret Prescott.
And good morning. You're listening to KBO Portland. The time is 9 o'clock. Up next, we have Press Watch. At 10 o'clock, it's Air Cascadia, headlines, interviews, and commentary. At 10:15, it's Flashpoints with Dennis Bernstein. At 11, it is Between the Covers. At 11:30, we have The Film Show. All these KBU programs are made possible by members' support. If you'd like to become a member, go to kbu.fm and click on Donate.
KBU Community Radio cordially invites you to the Women of KBU Celebration and Open House on Friday, June 29th from 7 to 10 p.m. It's here at the station, 20 Southeast 8th Avenue. Join us for the open house and an evening of on-air programming hosted by Barbara Bernstein and featuring Carol Major, Victoria Stapiello, and Maureen Key. We're celebrating the contribution of women.